Sound good? Okay, well, thank you very much. And first of all, thank you all for turning out on a Saturday morning. It's very impressive. Thank you for coming to hear me talk. I'm sure if I did this in Australia, I'm not sure I'd get people away from the beach or wherever they go on the Saturday morning, the shopping mall. So first of all, I'd like to thank Barry and Laurie for allowing us to have this event here at the university. And, of course, the organisers, Tuomo and Pietra and Eva and others who have organised over a while to get me here. We've been talking for a few years now about visiting Finland and also perhaps translating this book that I'm going to be talking about, Take Back the Economy. And afterwards, anyone that's interested in helping raise money to do that, I'd like to talk to you. So it's just a great delight to be here, and I've learnt a lot already just from my short visit in Tampere. I've learnt to say moi and kiitos, apart from other things. So today I want to talk about this book, Take Back the Economy, An Ethical Guide for Transforming Our Communities. And this was published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2013. And it was written with my colleagues Jenny Cameron and Stephen Healy. But we started this project of writing the book in 2008 before my colleague Julie Graham died. So Julie and I were, you know, very involved in the beginnings of this book, and it developed a lot with through the engagement with Jenny and Stephen, who are kind of past PhD students who are now teaching Jenny at the University of Newcastle in Australia. And Stephen Healy is now at the Institute of Culture and Society with me at Western Sydney. So it draws on our kind of collective experience as geographers who, for Julie and I at least, were trained in political economy, particularly Marxian political economy. And it represents, I think, probably for us the most concerted effort or attempt that we've made as yet to begin to integrate a, more of a profound ecological sensibility into our rethinking of economy. As our work really started with an engagement with Marxism and feminism, and in some ways ecology was really not part of our thinking, even though Julie had started off in the environmental movement and come into geography because of that. But here we're responding then to some of the profound challenges of the Anthropocene, this new kind of geological era in which the Earth is being remade by urban industrial action. And, of course, there's a lot of debate about what we name this era. I won't get into that, but I think it's true to say that whatever this this period we've moved into is, and whatever we call it, it's demanding that we humans rethink ourselves as a species among other species living on this planet. So what does that mean for rethinking the economy? I guess that's what we've tried to take on in this book. And the book is really written as a popular text. It's written with groups of people in mind, students and teachers, community activists, congregations, unions, associations. The idea is to, what we were proposing was that it's a book to be read together with others, to think with others and start to act with others. So it's really designed to provoke ethical action for our times. It's not really a blueprint in any way. It's really something I hope that will get conversations going. It's informed by a range of theories, anti-essentialist political economy, theories of performativity, influenced by the new materialism or material semiotics. But largely it's written in a pretty accessible style, in English at least, and we've avoided kind of abstract theoretical language so that it can be more accessible. As I said, it doesn't lay down a blueprint, but it presents what we call a set of thinking practices or techniques for making other worlds possible. And originally we thought it was to be a kind of popular version of a book that Julie and I wrote in 2006 called A Post-Capitalist Politics, where we outlined three kinds of politics: a politics of language, a politics of the subject, and a politics of collective action. But as we worked on this book, it became something more. So now we're kind of doing the more academic thing of filling in the backstory theoretically to some of the chapters. But what I'm going to do is just talk about what's in the book. I want to present than some of these techniques for thinking that we've used. And I start with the technique of reframing and then move on to some of the simple tools that we've used for reorienting ourselves to ethical actions for people and the planet. So I guess this lecture is an invitation to kind of join this experiment and begin to observe the kind of changes that happen when we start to reframe, inventory, think, and then potentially start to act differently, and what these kind of techniques can provoke. So one of the premises of this book is that our current understanding of what constitutes an economy is standing in the way of responsibly facing the future and taking action to learn to live in our world in new ways, ways that are less destructive of the very fabric of life as we've known it over the long interglacial summer. This is the long summer that Diane Dumanovsky talks about. So the take back of the book is a title borrowed from the catch cry of feminist marches in the 1970s and the 1980s to take back the night, so that it was safe for women to walk on the streets. The take back then we refer to is one that demobilises the prevalent idea that the economy is somehow a matter of fact, a matter indeed of kind of closed facts that adequately reflect reality and that operate together in known and predictable ways. So this is the kind of machinic vision of the economy, usually called capitalism, which continues to be represented as the ultimate real, despite the kind of guerrilla attacks that J.K. Gibson Graham have been lobbing at it for more than 20 years. And I just put this up. This is the cover of the Turkish translation of The End of Capitalism, as we knew it, and the subtitle was A Feminist Critique of Political Economy, obviously a reference to Marx's Capital. As you can see, the machinic economy is represented here, and I think it was an old environmental kind of poster that the Turks took to modify. There we have the economy, churning up people and livelihoods, and pushing out smoke and pollution, churning up the earth, eating up its resources. And Julie and I are the kind of little Davids lobbing our slingshots and pebbles at this Goliath. In the kind of reference to the biblical story. This cover we loved because it was very different from the original cover of the book that Blackwell put out in 1996, which had Sisyphus rolling a huge stone up the hill and for the stone to come rolling back. And it was all black and red and white, and it looked like something out of some Germanic Marxian party of the 1960s or something. Anyway, the colours of this one much more excited us. But anyway, we've been kind of throwing our metaphoric pebbles for over 20 years now, and the machine economy is still with us. But I think it's now pretty reasonably accepted, probably amongst everybody except certain people in economics departments, that this machinic vision is built out of models of the economy that have then become models for economic behaviour, models that are moulded by metrics and technologies that perform national economies as large-scale economic experiments. I mean, you don't often hear economists talking about their economies as experiments, but I think that's what we'd like to say they really are. So here's the the monetary national income analog computer that was built in 1949, which was used. It used water to model how money flowed around the UK economy and when government policy should come in or could come in to intervene or stop off or enable flow. So this was a model that was actually concretely built, and there are a few of these models still around in various departments. One of them is in Cambridge, and there's a very entertaining YouTube clip of this guy making it work, opening spigots and closing spigots and so on. Here we have the kind of engineering or hydraulic interactions that model the kind of interactions that were used in both Keynesian and neoliberal economic doctrines. And scholars such as Michel Calon and Timothy Mitchell and Donald McKenzie have shown how these economic doctrines have been used all over the world to construct national economies. And we talked yesterday about the ways in which the gross domestic product project in Finland came to define the Finnish economy in a certain way. So the work that's been done by scholars coming more out of, an actor network theory kind of approach on the performativity of economics synchronises very well with studies of biopower, the subject of governmentality studies. Biopower is that particular form of power that's exerted over and through the life of populations via health practices, sexual regulation, medical paradigms, economic systems, and so on. So in the economic realm, according to some, we are all governed by neoliberal capitalist biopower. And certainly I think we could admit that we are enrolled in the experimental apparatus of business as usual. And this happens in laboratories that are set up to test consumer behaviour and decision-making under controlled settings, and also in real-world sites, such as the current context in which the models of impact of carbon taxes, for instance, on different groups are being tested and tweaked against public opinion and the calculative practices of energy providers and governments. So in this, in the economy as machinery imaginary, we are confined to a very limited set of roles and a narrow set of motivations. Individuals or subjects are seen as either employees who are motivated by the desire for higher wages, where we are either interpolated as owners, business owners, or entrepreneurs who want more profits and lower costs, especially labour costs. We are enrolled as consumers who supposedly want more stuff for less payout. We are seen as property owners who have rights to private property and want higher and higher returns from that private property, or investors who also want greater returns from financial investment. Up against this kind of model of the economy, it's very hard, and it's a model for the economy and it's a model for economic behaviour, it's very hard to even think how can we start to take back the economy so that concern for well-being, that of ourselves and of others and earth others, is centre stage. The kind of dominant representation of capitalism is so dominant, with its encompassing power, with its generalisable dynamics that are seen as real dynamics, and its kind of enlarged spaces of agency, that as communities in its face, we kind of cower in its presence. So this is where a kind of technique of thinking, of reframing and thinking and remaking the world comes in. So, you know, as we all know, to reframe is to change our understanding, to refocus on different things, and perhaps to foreground something that's been in the background. And this is the, you know, the familiar figure ground shift between two faces or a vase. Which one is it? So for me, and I spoke about this yesterday, and apologies for repetition here, but for me, the most important reframing to have occurred in the last 100 years or so has been the one that's been brought about by the feminist movement, where this kind of intervention by feminists has produced a very different discourse of what it is to be a woman. It's brought to light the hidden histories and her stories that of who holds up half the world. It's liberated women to take up many different roles that were previously they were limited to take up. And it's also prompted a very different way of thinking about the world, one that puts care and life and kind of interconnection, fundamental interconnection, at the centre of our thinking. So in the work with Julie, the reframing offered by feminism has been, I guess, one of the major inspirations that informed the way in which we started to rethink the economy. If it was possible to have a feminist revolution, why was it we always had to wait for a left revolution, somehow always being deferred into some future? So the feminist message is a hopeful one. It takes a step beyond the traditional Marxist adage that we understand the world in order to change it. It tells us that changing our understanding is to change the world, if only partially and locally. So when we represent the economy not as a machine-like entity, but as an outcome of everyday human action, we're able to map out many ways that new practices of our economy are emerging and can be strengthened. So in Take Back the Economy, we challenge the identity of the economy as inevitably capitalist, and take back the economy for people and the planet by focusing on the ethical decisions that inform multiple economic dynamics. So each chapter takes a mainstream economic term like work, business, markets, property and finance, and then takes it back by reframing this kind of field, this domain, as a space of ethical decision-making, then reclaiming it then for what we might call a community economy rather than a capitalist economy, and I'll explain that in a minute. So if the economy isn't represented as a machine that operates in a predictable way, with economists kind of pulling levers to control money supply or labour markets, then we can't set a course and expect that things will systematically unfold. And if our Earth isn't this kind of bottomless resource pit that is seen here in this slide, we can't keep feeding it to a machine to be gobbled up and spewed out. We've got to find other metaphors, other frames of meaning that inspire new ways of being and acting. And for us, this is where the diverse economy framing comes in. It widens the scope of what makes up the economy, that is, the identity of the economy, and then opens up for discussion what might be the economic dynamics that we would like to activate, rather than seeing them as this machinic kind of dictates that come out of these relationships that are mechanised somehow. So in our work with communities interested in different life-affirming development pathways, we've used this image of the iceberg economy to help people see that we are all, and they are all, contributing to an economy that meets material needs and distributes wealth and well-being. So above the waterline here, in this very familiar kind of image of visibility and invisibility, above the waterline we see the activities that are usually recognised as being part of the real economy. You know, those that are producing commodities for markets, those in which people are working as wage labourers in mainstream or capitalist business. And below the waterline, we see a whole mix of activities, a kind of chaotic mess of activities that are also necessary for survival and that produce well-being and sometimes produce ill-being too. But work in the home, in the neighbourhood, production for use, not for exchange, self-provisioning, interactions with nature, other kinds of enterprises like cooperatives. This image kind of produces a figure ground shift for many people who see themselves now as contributing to an economy, whereas before they saw themselves as marginal. So when I've worked in Melanesia and the Pacific, we've used, instead of the iceberg, which didn't seem too relevant in those contexts, we used the floating coconut as an image to try and map what people were doing to make a living. And as you can see, this was a project looking at what might be community-based or indicators of gender equality in the Pacific, where we're not imposing a particular vision of what gender equality is. So the division was kind of... we used this as a way of separating out what was men's work and women's work and work that they did together. But as you can see, the bulk of the activities are here below the waterline, and the number of activities that are seen in the formal economy that economists focus on are these very few activities up here and above the waterline, and many of them are involved with government services. So as the free trade agreements across the Pacific are being kind of negotiated or imposed, what will happen to the kind of these non-market livelihoods that people are resting on and many of their survival practices are based on is a big question mark. So this research was really trying to say, let's start by looking at what people are doing now, how gender equality is practiced, or where areas are for improvement, and what will happen as economies change in light of the certain kinds of directions that are being foisted on people. So this idea of the diverse economy widens the scope of what makes up our economy, and here we're drawing, of course, on established bodies of work in anthropology, in informal sector studies, in economic sociology, in development studies, in the cooperative movement and community activism. So what we're doing is gathering together the heterogeneous range of economic activities and arraying them then in a kind of more systematic framework rather than the kind of jumble of activities that you saw in the iceberg image. So the ways in which we've done that is to arrange these activities in terms of columns, each pertaining to a different kind of practice. The practice of labouring and remunerating that labour, practices of transactions, including market and non-market ones, practices of business or enterprise, and practices of finance, I'll go on to that in a minute, and property. So the idea here is to, the tip of the iceberg is just in these top cells, wage labour, but we can start to look at the ways in which many kinds of labour is remunerated in different ways that are not moderated by classic labour markets. Self-employed labour, for instance. Reciprocal labour that's practiced in many communities, particularly in agricultural communities, and I think probably not that long ago, even in Finnish agricultural communities, people doing harvest for each other and reciprocating that kind of labour. Many of the kinds of ways in which labour is remunerated in kind, and forms of work for welfare. And, of course, all the unpaid kinds of labour that feminists have been so keen to bring to the fore, housework, volunteering, the kind of self-provisioning work that goes on with gardening and producing your own food. And as I hasten to add, when we do this diverse economy inventory, this is not what we're desiring, this is what's here. And so we include the things that we would like to see disappearing, such as slave labour, which is still a part of our global economy in many places. When it comes to thinking about transactions, we've got formal market transactions, but we've also got many different kinds of alternative market transactions in which different kinds of ethics and practices and social relationships overdetermine the way in which the transaction takes place, such as in fair trade networks, in alternative currencies or time banks, in the underground market, where there might be kind of coercive relationships between social groups and barter. But we also include all the non-market transactions here that take place through sharing, through gift giving, through interacting with nature, through hunting and fishing, through practices of gleaning, which have taken form throughout history and today probably are most represented by dumpster diving, gleaning from all the leftover food that's available, but including also theft, which is one form of redistribution in some way, or non-market exchange and poaching. And then when it comes to thinking about enterprise, we have formal capitalist or mainstream business enterprise where wealth is generated, surplus is appropriated and privately appropriated and accumulated, versus other forms of enterprise which might look very similar to mainstream capitalist enterprise, but where there's some other kind of governing rule, such as in state-owned enterprise, where profits potentially could be accrued and put back into society, or socially responsible firms where there is a commitment to redistributing some wealth back into a community or into environments, and non-profits where, again, the business is supposedly for a social purpose rather than private accumulation. And, of course, there's a lot of interest these days in what I might call non-capitalist enterprises where wealth is being produced and distributed under very different kinds of relationships, like in worker cooperatives, community enterprise or social enterprise. And, of course, the long-standing forms of enterprise that's probably the most prevalent around the world, which is self-employment or sole proprietorship, where even though the development agencies like to see microfinance and small micro-enterprise somehow blossoming into capitalist business, mostly it's a kind of form of survival business. So here we have the diversity of enterprise forms. And similarly, we can look at the diversity of property relations, private property relations, and then a whole range of alternative forms of private property relations where other non-individualised kind of agents are exerting some sort of private rule. Community land trusts, customary or clan land, and state-managed assets. And, of course, something that's very important today, which is the resources where property relations are being fought over, what kind of relationships of ownership will happen and care or commoning might happen around open access resources like the atmosphere, international waters and intellectual property. And lastly, the book talks about the diversity of financial sector involvement. There's mainstream banks and financial institutions, and then a whole range of other kinds of alternative market financial institutions, including credit unions that might have been set up by workers originally to help them deal with issues of loss of income and so on. State banks, again, set up with some kind of social purpose originally, although obviously that has often changed. Microfinance and community financial institutions. And then all the many ways in which people have of investing in each other through non-market mechanisms like family lending, donations, interest-free loans and sweat equity. The important thing to remember here is that a diverse economy framing doesn't suggest that we can ignore these relationships in these top cells. And in fact, we could start to do as we did in a post-capitalist politics and diversify those top cells in many ways as well. And that's another kind of a project. But I guess at the moment I'm trying to just introduce this idea of a diverse economy to say that what we have here is the opportunity to explore the kind of complex interactions that take place within diverse economies and start to experiment with different development pathways that are oriented differently to the growth of, or oriented directly to the growth of well-being, rather than thinking of well-being as only coming through the growth of those relationships in the top sector and via then this sort of circuitous route of investment growth and then trickle-down effects, you know, so that we'll get well-being only if we go and get a job and then get the money to buy food and then, you know, spread that money around, etc. So are there ways that we can think about putting these different activities together within a diverse economy to generate different kinds of futures? So I guess that's the question. How do we move from this reframing to strategies that help to build new futures? As I said before, the growth machine is framed in terms of development being linked to growth, and particularly growth of all these things: higher wages, higher profits, cheaper goods, more private property, unregulated gambling. That seems to be the ways in which many governments are promoting what should our future should be linked to. And our question is, can we then take back the economy and work towards a different future? And in doing that, what we've done is try to reframe and recenter our thinking, not around higher and higher wages, but around things like surviving well. What is necessary for human survival? How can we survive together with each other and Earth others and live equitably and well through the ways in which we might draw on diverse labour practices, for instance? All of us do this. All of us do already are involved in diverse labour practices. But what's the mix that we're involved in? And what kind of well-being is created from it? How might we think about enterprise as a site where wealth is generated and distributions of wealth could happen? Rather than seeing distributions of wealth only happening by the state, how is it that enterprise is itself a place where new kinds of distributions can emerge that might enrich societal and environmental health? Rather than thinking about transactions only in terms of how do we get more for less, how can we think about transactions as a place where we relate to other people and to other environments, often those that are at a distance from ourselves? Clearly, we need to have complex sets of interactions, some of which need to be mediated by markets. But how do we encounter others in ways that support their well-being as well as ours? So these are the kind of concerns that can replace the kinds of very limited motivational kind of focus of a more capitalist-oriented economy. When it comes to thinking about property, how might we think about the resources that we need to maintain our lives and that the planet needs to maintain itself as objects that can be commoned, where we can maintain and replenish the gifts of nature and intellect that all humans rely on by caring for natural and cultural commons? What are the practices that could be involved in reframing relationships to ownership and through access and use and commoning? And lastly, then, how might we think of finance not just as a way of getting ahead by getting more from each investment, but finance as, you know, getting back to its basics, like why do we save in order to have a future or to invest in the future? How do we invest our wealth, and how can we invest it so that future generations can live well? And in all these kinds of questioning, I think the question of sustainability and consumption has to come up. What do we use up and consume in the process of satisfying our needs, and how can we consume sustainably? And that really comes into all these other domains. So unlike the kind of structurally configured economy with its regularities and lawful relationships, where we're told, well, the bottom line is this, you know, you have to succumb to these logics, otherwise, you know, we don't have a future. The community economy is an acknowledged space of social interdependency and self-formation that centres on these kinds of concerns, surviving well together and with the earth, distributing surplus, encountering others ethically, commoning, investing in futures, and consuming sustainably. Of course, the term community is a problematic term for many people. And what we've done is draw a lot from a particularly kind of anti-essentialist vision of community, where it's the community economy is acknowledged as a space of social interdependency. So it's not a blueprint that we're laying out. It's kind of an unmapped and uncertain terrain that then calls forth these exploratory conversations and political and ethical acts of decision. So in a sense, we're evacuating the essentialism that's often associated with economy and evacuating the essentialism that's often associated with community, as, you know, those people that are all the same or in the locality and somehow know each other, can work with each other. We're saying, no, let's look at these things as spaces of negotiation where, in terms of the community, our being in common is the basis for the need to negotiate, rather than our sense that we don't need to negotiate because we're all kind of somehow the same in a kind of cloying sense of community. Both those meanings of community, I think, are in that word, and we can discuss that later as to whether the strategic use of that term resonates with, and it does resonate in different parts of the world with different languages. In France, for instance, the term community is very freighted with a particular set of meanings, so it's a difficult one to translate. Okay, so what I've done is talk about reframing economic identity by starting with this kind of inventory of a diverse economy and then introducing the idea that there might be different kinds of dynamics that we can be involved in the economy, rather than these kind of mechanistic ones, ones that we can activate through ethical action. And really what I want to do now is just illustrate some of the tools that we've come up with to try and guide ethical action. So in each case, our tool involves an inventory, which you've already seen kind of how that works. And the other tools then help us to identify and evaluate our levels of interdependence with each other and earth others. So I want to illustrate, first of all, by the example of work and labour. And these are some of the kind of little tools that we've developed in the book. I'm not sure I'm going to get through all of them, but I'll go through a few of them just to illustrate the kind of thinking with that we're inviting people to do with us. So if we start to reframe work or labour in terms of this concern, this community economy concern with surviving well, we need to think here about not just surviving well ourselves individually, surviving well with others, other humans, but also surviving well with the earth. And I think this is where, you know, some of the issues that have come around the kinds of politics of survival or necessity that have been associated particularly with the working class movement perhaps need to rethink a little bit now in the light of the issues around climate change. So how do we trade off different survival needs, those of ourselves, those of others, and those of the earth? Well, the first step is perhaps to do a simple time use analysis. You know, this is a technique that's been used in sociology many times. Assemble what you do every hour of the day, but then to use it in a diverse economy way, to start to classify that labour in terms of the different forms of work that's performed. And this is something that, again, feminists have been very interested for people to do. How much unpaid labour you do in the household, how much in the community, how much for paid labour, how does this interact? This is a profile for a fictitious Australian coal miner. I've done a lot of work in the past in this extractive industry, where, over the last... since I started working in the 80s in this industry, the 12-hour shift has become the norm. In fact, many people even work more than a 12-hour shift. Many communities that used to be live-in communities have now become live-out, bus-in, bus-out, or fly-in, fly-out communities because of this work profile. People come and work for 4 or 5 days, 12 hours, then they go and leave, go and live on the coast and then come back. So the workplace has become a set of labour camps where... people often have to travel in buses out to the mines. Their recreation is limited. Their rest is, potentially also fought into by work. And in many cases, the kind of remuneratory reward, which is huge in this industry, particularly in the coal industry, the fossil fuel industry. It's the kind of wage level, way beyond those of university professors, that buys a certain allegiance to the fossil fuel industry. It's also the sort of work-life balance that leads to ill health, to family breakdown, to mining community social dysfunction because of this fly-in, fly-out situation. So this is a kind of work-life balance where the trade-offs are very clear. More money for the individual, potentially for the individual family, or maybe the family will break up very soon, in order to live a particular lifestyle and perhaps have a certain future with very little regard to other kinds of issues. This was the part of the cartoon that came out of a booklet I worked with miners' wives who were very concerned about what this kind of change of shift was happening in terms of households and the livelihoods of people in communities. By contrast, here's a work profile of a farmer, a representative farmer in a community in the Philippines where many farmers are tenanted farmers. They work on their land in order to be paid in kind by rice payments for the year. But they also have to find work as labourers, get paid work. And then as part of the rural community, they engage in a lot of unpaid work that helps each other, such as reciprocal labour exchange, volunteer work in the community and on the irrigation ditches and so on, and recreation. A very different, diverse economy labour profile. The question then is, how do we start to think about well-being in relation to these different mixes? And you could do this kind of exercise for yourself, and I have, and I think I'm much more like the Australian coal miner than I am the Filipino farmer, unfortunately. But one then needs to ask, what kind of well-being is being created by this kind of labour profile? And here, drawing again on lots of the research that's done around well-being, we need to look at multiple dimensions of well-being: material well-being, occupational well-being, social, community, and physical well-being. So how is it and how are we balancing the kind of time we put into paid and unpaid work versus the time we put into life and well-being? These are the kinds of balancing acts that many people, we're all doing, and we're all kind of perhaps blindly going along with. So one could start to then monitor in terms of a well-being scorecard. How does this profile match up? So for the case of the Filipino farmer, materially, they're not very well off if we think of one as poor and three as good. Occupationally, they're reasonably okay in terms of enjoying the farming work. Socially, and in terms of community integration, there's a lot, particularly in these kinds of communities where there's so much integration through both festivities but also shared work. And physically, people are hard up often because of the way in which healthcare has been very badly distributed in many communities. The next thing then would be to say, well, what kind of profile, what does this work-life balance, this set of well-being parameters, what does it mean in terms of the well-being of the earth? How does this work-life profile match with the kind of survival likelihood of planetary Earth, planetary health? And we can use, again, the kind of techniques that have been developed, problematic though they might be in their individual elements, to try and look at planetary survival through the ecological footprint. And then we might go back and say, well, let's just pretend that our 24-hour clock is a world. Let's expand it to think of how many worlds would it take if everybody lived like this, or contract it. And in the case of the comparison between a Filipino farmer and an Australian coal miner, where the average ecological footprint of an Australian would take 3.5 planets if everybody lived the way we did, and potentially the coal miner would be even more, versus less than 7 planets in the case of the Philippines. We can start to think of what is the ethical interaction we have with those others in the world around our consumption habits, our work-life balance. Why is it that, you know, beyond a certain level of income, something like $7,000 a year, happiness doesn't really shift that much in the world? And what does that mean for taking back this economy that we're somehow implicated in? So these are kind of the ways in which we are thinking about these kind of conversations one could have in different groups. And in the book, after each of these kinds of sets of issues, we then start to look at the different kinds of collective actions that are happening all around the world that are trying to increase the ability for people to survive well. And, of course, some of these are strategies that are occupying, you know, are focused in the strategies that need to be done associated with formal wage labour. For instance, all the kind of activism around minimum wages, say in the US, you know, still the struggle to get $15 as a minimum wage so people can actually live off the income they make as workers. But also the idea of universal living wages, like the basic income grant, which is all the different sort of struggles that are being saying, let's have fair work and wages and reduce the precarity of those who are working many hours for very little reward. But there's also the many different struggles to kind of work less and redefine what we need. The attempts to try and reduce the working week. You know, somehow over the last 20 years in Australia, where we won the 35-hour week, people are now working, you know, on average 40 to 50 hours. What's gone on there, you know? Why is it that we can't start to introduce a 21-hour week in the formal economy? And what would that mean for the rest of the diverse economic practices we could be involved in? Clearly, the voluntary simplicity movement is one that's saying we don't need to live on so much. We probably don't need to work as hard as we do. But, of course, it also means putting pressure on governments to continue to provide public goods that help people all to live well. And the debate around taxation, which sees it as not an investment in people's futures, and ways of the discourse of taxation has been so formed, you know, brought back to individual greed, really, and the need not to pay tax, versus the need to support things like public goods, is a really interesting discourse that needs to be thought through from a diverse economy perspective. The more there are public goods, the more that we can have a diverse profile of labour practices and potentially work-life balance. And these are just some of the strategies around the world to try and ensure that public goods and support for livelihoods is given. And obviously this is unevenly developed around the world. And lastly, there are kind of ways that people are directly helping to create well-being through direct provision of goods, such as housing, education, and in just my own backyard, the direct labour of caring for the environment through bush care groups all over Sydney, maintaining the health of the natural environment through volunteer labour. So we could start to proliferate all the different actions that are taking place to try and help individuals to work better, to survive well, and to produce more planetary well-being as well. And, of course, these things are all kind of a sort of disaggregated and punctiform politics, but in the kind of vision of the kind of practices that I'm drawing together here within a community economy, they can be seen as kind of connected and interrelated. Potentially, and perhaps we need a different kind of language for doing that interconnection. So the strategies, the thinking techniques are here identified. First of all, diversify practices, Secondly, reframe in terms of community economy concerns. Third, explore interdependence. Then identify the dilemmas and look at for the collective actions that are trying to do something around those dilemmas. They're very simple steps, and they're the kind of thing that once you start to do them as a group, interesting kind of ideas and new experiments can emerge. So in each of the dimensions, then, of the diverse economy, this is the kind of practice that we engage in. And I'll just very quickly go through some of the other techniques in the time I have left so that we'll have time for commentary and so on. So moving to the issue of encountering others, here again the inventory might be not just in terms of what kinds of transactions are we involved in to survive. One can go and look in your cupboard or look in your house and start to map out where are the goods coming from that you have. And this is just an example of the electronics, the clothing and footwear and the food that was in my house at one particular time. Where am I getting these goods from? And what is my relationship with the people who made those goods and the environments from which those goods have come from? In some cases I know, and in many cases I don't. This is an inventory of where does the simple tomato come from? Not just looking at mainstream. I mean, these ones are all kind of mainstream market relations with minority world and majority world and domestic connections. But in here, this case, we're looking at the different kinds of transactions, indirect ones through mainstream markets, you know, buying pureed tomatoes that have been made in Australia, buying tomato paste that's been produced in Thailand, but also the kind of reciprocal transactions that, or ones in which there's some form of ethical interaction through, for instance, community-supported agriculture, where there's some reciprocity in pricing so that the farmer has a good life, reciprocity with neighbours, backyard produce, and gifting that happens particularly in summertime when these products are easily available. So the diverse encounter dandelion is just a very simple way that one can sort of inventory on a personal level where goods and services are coming from. And, of course, there's many ways that we can start to monitor how responsible those connections might be through the kinds of consumer activism that's happened recently around, buying local or knowing about the environment in which foods come and all the kind of new labelling that many groups are starting to enforce so that we can find out more about, you know, who has made this good. Is their well-being taken into account in terms of the wage levels they've been paid? Are these products coming from a community or a national context in which there's political democracy? And, you know, the movement around all the conflict minerals is one of the cases where this kind of tracking back to the ethical interactions that we might be ignoring if we use certain kinds of phones and so on. So these kinds of techniques and questions can be asked of all these transactions, and then we can start to think about other ways of accessing goods and services. And I like this example of the Feral Trade Network, which is an artist, Kate Rich, has generated, which is... She's a bit critical of some of the ways in which fair trade has become institutionalised, and so she started a feral trade or import-export business that moves coffee around the world via artists who travel She uses cabin luggage and exit space in their suitcases to move goods from different places in the world. And each kilo of coffee has this very detailed kind of documentation of how much money went to the farmers, went to the port, was lost through bad malpractice or some sort of accident. And she's trying to, as both an art project but as a real project of getting coffee to people, produce an understanding that we can be more connected into the world through taking attention or paying attention to these commodity supply chains. So, I mean, of course, there's many other strategies that we can use there, and I haven't really got time to go into those. But it takes a lot of work, obviously, to do that kind of ethical interrogation of how one is encountering others through the transactions that produce the kind of well-being that we enjoy. And for those who don't enjoy it, you know, what's missing out? When it comes to thinking about business, the question, the community economy concern, is how do we generate and distribute society's surplus here, thinking about the wealth that is generated in enterprise as a form of societal surplus. And here, you know, building on the kind of idea of survival versus surplus, survival payments being the kind of payment one gets for working in an enterprise, and then the surplus that's generated being what is then used to, apart from what's used to pay back the inputs into a business, what is the kind of what becomes sometimes seen as profit or becomes distributions to those other activities that allow the conditions of existence for enterprise. So clearly a lot of surplus must flow back to the financiers, to governments, to insurance agents, to researchers who do R&D and so on. But of course, in many enterprises, particularly big capitalist enterprises at the moment, there's been a lot of attention paid to how much of the surplus or wealth that's been generated it gets paid to CEOs in these huge salaries, how much gets put into government or into political parties, election campaigns, for instance. We can do this kind of distributional mapping of what happens to society's wealth through these kind of interrogations of enterprise or an alternative or people's account of enterprise. And we can also use this kind of people's account to build different kinds of enterprises where, for instance, there's more economic democracy. There's discussion of the wealth that's generated, how much should flow back to the wages of cooperators, for instance, how much needs to flow back into the business costs and or into the growth of the business, and how much could be used to be distributed more widely to community health or to social health or environmental health. And so this kind of a people's account is something you can use to interrogate the kind of enterprises that you're involved in, whether it's a capitalist enterprise, self-employment, or social enterprise. And the interest these days in cooperatives, I think, and in transitioning into employee ownership is one of the interesting moves where these kinds of accounts are very important. And this is the kind of mapping of solidarity economy businesses in New York City, where not only are people looking into what's going on within the wealth they generate, but how they can build more connection between other enterprises that are putting these ethical concerns on centre stage, and how these economies or these enterprises can be integrated more through supply chain connections and other kinds of activism around regulations and so on. And social enterprise, of course, is another area that where this kind of enterprise is being used for different purposes than purely private appropriation, and it's a very contested area at the moment, I think, within development, the development field, where a certain kind of social entrepreneurship is being fostered and foisted on many people rather than a sense of community enterprise. And lastly, commoning, which is, I haven't got time to probably go through all of this, but one of our techniques, and anyone that's been trained as a geographer might kind of recognise the old time geography diagram here, where we can help people can kind of start to map out through their daily routes and life ways the many different kinds of property regimes you move through time. And I won't go into the detail here, but what we've done in the book is try to identify where are these spaces commoned. In other words, trying to dissociate the notion of commoning from property ownership per se. Many people have seen, you know, the commons has to be publicly owned. But what we're saying is if you think of the commoning as a practice of sharing access, negotiating use, distributing the benefit of access to some kind of property form widely, caring for that resource and taking responsibility for it, it can happen in a range of different contexts, including with private property. So, in fact, there are many ways in which there are commons that we are participating in, or commons that we could participate in more And this is just an analysis of that time geography map. But here's thinking of ways of commoning, that ways in which we can common enclosed property, create new commons, and start to common unmanaged resources. And as you can see in the ownership column here, the idea is that this commoning can happen with a range of different ownership types and need not be necessarily linked to legal ownership, although this is an interesting kind of debate as how this can happen. And the work of that some of the people in our Community Economies Collective has done is to start to do this mapping. Here we have the seafloor commons that was mapped by fishermen coming from these communities on the New England coast, where they operate, and really, even though they're highly individualised fishermen, they actually operate in a way to take care of the seafloor commons and the fish species that fish in those areas. And work by Kevin St. Martin has used this to try and interact with fisheries science to start to produce the sense, the idea of the reality of community in these fisheries science kind of regimes where everything has been individualised in terms of individual quotas and so on. So this is some of the commoning that's taking place in Paris and is happening all over the world with the development of community gardens and so on. And there's a bit of an interesting story around this agro-city, which I just visited last week, where this incredible garden has been produced in and commoned out of what you see before, which is sort of just asphalt and tarmac, and with support of EU money and the local municipality. But unfortunately, the mayor changed with the shift to the right in local politics in France, and now they want to put a temporary car park back on top of this. So this is where the struggles around commoning are very pertinent and are very much, I guess, of the moment. And I think we had a set of sessions at the American Geography Conferences on commoning as a post-capitalist politics. And I think that term is getting a lot of momentum these days, and probably is a kind of nodal point for many kinds of community economy interactions. We also talk about intergenerational caring for commons, which I won't go into on now because I haven't got time. But it's really looking at the ways in which there have been attempts to try and common the atmosphere through time. Of course, that's one of our big challenges at the moment, how to continue to common and not not pollute this environment, this atmosphere that is still unregulated in so many ways. So just to conclude in the last 2 minutes, I want to then just lastly consider our role as academics and researchers in trying to make other worlds possible, which is the title of this recent collected edition that came out again with Minnesota Press. Bruno Latour argues that under the guise of studying reality, academic disciplines are actually extending the range of entities that work in the world and actively participating in transforming some of them into faithful and stable intermediaries. And this is a very inspiring kind of vision in a way, perhaps maybe overstating our power, but I think we are implicated in these kinds of processes. And I'd like to kind of juxtapose this statement that he makes about what economists are doing with what we're trying to do in Take Back the Economy. So Latour's example is that he says that economists, for instance, are not simply describing some economic infrastructure, which has always been there somehow from the beginning of time, no matter how much they might like to represent, that's what they're doing. They're in fact revealing calculative abilities in actors who didn't know before that they had them, and making sure that some of these new competencies are sunk into common sense through the many practical tools of bank accounts, property rights, cash register slips and other plug-ins. And it's through those kind of technologies that those motivations of, you know, wanting higher wages, wanting more interest payments, wanting to consume more, etc., have become normalised in some ways. We're locked into these kind of technological apparatuses, and our motivations and desires are integrated somehow into these kinds of technologies. And I guess what we've tried to do in Take Back the Economy is to reveal the ethical abilities in actors who didn't know potentially that they had them or might not have found them, making sure that some of these new competencies are sunk into common sense through a new set of practical tools. And the practical tools are very minimal and are very provisional. But I guess the idea is that the more of these kinds of ethical interaction kind of tools we put out there, the more the opportunity for ethical discussion takes place, the more we can shift into a different kind of subjectivity and alight those different desires for a different kind of world, a different kind of world in which we are attentive to our own needs, those of others, those of our planet, and that we can act and produce an economy that honours those needs. So this manual, or this pedagogy for building community economies, is a hope, we hope, a contribution to enacting other worlds. Thank you.